With all the flippancy that my personality seems to afford me, it might be taken by some that I think of Jim in some sense as just a guy. But in fact, though he's just, I guess, a few years older than me, I'm almost 50, and we won't say where you are, but you're just a few years up there. Jim makes me feel little. Not because Jim wants me to feel little, but because we have our heroes, and they're always just big to us. And Jim is just that kind of guy. We love him. We're thankful for him. And so glad, in the providence of God, you were able to be here this time. And I was talking with Dr. Oliver a few years back in email. We were going to plan to have Dr. Oliver and Jim do this together. And that wasn't going to work. He wasn't going to be able to be here. And so I emailed Dr. Oliver and said, well, he's not going to make it. And but what did I know? God knew he was going to make it. And so I'm very thankful for that. And I know we all are. So Jim, come. Bring us your message.
As I've been sitting and listening to my highly esteemed brothers speak, I realized why it is that this conference and its theme is important. It really is. Let me give you some names. Jeremiah Burroughs. You know the name Jeremiah Burroughs. You may have some of his books on your shelf. He was a contemporary of Christopher Blackwood, but you've never heard of Blackwood before. But I would argue that Blackwood is just as important as Jeremiah Burroughs. Or Archibald Alexander, the great father, one of the fathers of American Presbyterianism. You've heard of him. You know his role in the formation, ultimately, of Princeton Seminary. But did you ever hear of Richard Furman before? And yet Furman is just as important for the Baptists as Alexander was for the Presbyterians. Or Gilbert Tennant. We hear about Gilbert Tennant, and we thank God for his role in the forward movement of the Great Awakening in the 18th century. But many of you perhaps never heard of Benjamin Bedon before, and we were introduced to him today. This is our history that's been hidden from us. We don't recognize the Baptist names, even though we recognize the others. But our history is full of important people and events, and it's been hidden from us. To some degree, it's been hidden because most of the reprinters, at least in our lifetime, have been Pedobaptists, Presbyterians, or Congregationalists, and they've reprinted their material, and that's good. But we have forgotten some of these folks who have been brought to us. And it just struck me how important it is for us to be able to recover our history. And so I'm very thankful to participate in this, and I hope that we'll be able to move forward and know these names. The work that you'll do on Benjamin Bedon is going to be of great benefit to the churches. And Dr. Oliver, thank you for telling us about Christopher Blackwood last night. In fact, I did something I would never usually do. I don't know if any of you noticed. When Dr. Oliver mentioned that he was speaking on Christopher Blackwood, I took out my phone and I texted my son. I would never do that in church. But my son Sam is very interested in Christopher Blackwood. And I texted him and I said, Dr. Oliver is speaking on Blackwood right now and it's being live streamed. And he wrote back to me, and at the end he said, that was a great lecture. So he watched the whole thing. I thought that was wonderful. And I told Dr. Oliver about it. In fact, Sam wanted to know, where are those letters, the Blackwood letters? So we've been texting about that. But it's wonderful to see these things and hear these things. Well, I was asked relatively late. I didn't think I was going to be able to speak, but almost at the last minute, I was able to come and to be here today. About 20 years ago, I was looking through a used book catalog, and I saw an advertisement for a pamphlet. Here it is. I brought it with me. It's ancient. And The advertisement said this, Philadelphia, First Baptist Church, and the title of the pamphlet, to the Baptist churches throughout the U.S. who adhere to the independent or congregational form of church government and to the doctrines contained in the Confession of Faith adopted by the Philadelphia Baptist Association, September 25, 1742, printed in Philadelphia in 1825. And apparently this says that I paid $18 for it, although that's 20 years ago. I don't remember how much I paid. But I bought this pamphlet because the title sounded interesting to me. It spoke about the Confession of Faith, and it was a letter that was written, published for the benefit of the churches that adhered to the Philadelphia Confession. Well, through all of these years, these two decades, and maybe even a little bit more, my interest was piqued by this, but I've never had the opportunity to look into it and to investigate it. But when I was asked to come and speak at a conference on Baptist history, I thought, well, here's my chance. Now I can look at this. Now I can think about this, and perhaps there's some material here. This is a document that comes from the First Baptist Church of Philadelphia, which describes and complains about a problem that existed in their church. There had been a church split, and it was appealing the case of the remaining body of the church, the larger body of the church, as over against the former members to the other Baptist churches in America. Now, on investigation, it became clear that this was the third in a close series of profound difficulties to present themselves in the First Baptist Church of Philadelphia, and they are of interest to us. Now, I have to warn you, it's a sad story. The historian of the First Baptist Church of Philadelphia, when they had their 200th anniversary in 1898, his name is William Keene, he says this, I have read and reread all of the voluminous minutes, pamphlets, reports, and papers relating to these years, and I must confess that they are dreary reading. Our fathers on both sides were often quick-tempered, ready to take offense and to give vent to their feelings in strong words and unwise deeds. When once Pandora's box is opened, what multitudes of afflictions are let loose? You know, in church history, we often think of the past as this idyllic thing, but that's really a myth. We lionize our heroes and we write hagiographic biographies about them. We skim over their faults and their transgressions. We too frequently ignore the harsh reality that these people lived in a fallen world. They, like us, were sinners. They were subject to the foibles and failings of humanity. And this was exactly the case at the beginning of the 19th century in a strange and protracted controversy between the First Baptist Church of Philadelphia, the Philadelphia Baptist Association, and the Triennial Convention. It involved men with large personalities. It developed from perceived personal slights, and it resulted in a separation between the church and the Philadelphia Association that lasted for more than 80 years. Now, what I want to do, by way of introduction, I want to give some preparatory remarks and then talk about these difficulties that presented themselves in First Baptist Church of Philadelphia. So I want to give you a brief history of that church and then brief biographical sketches of two of their pastors, William Staunton and Henry Holcomb, and then we'll speak about the difficulties that entered into the church. Okay? Now here's a brief history of the First Baptist Church of Philadelphia. It was founded in 1698. It's not the oldest, nor was it the largest of Baptist churches in the mid-Atlantic area of the East Coast during the 18th century. But its location in Philadelphia made it very important. At that time, Philadelphia was the continental capital, and thus it was the hub of the earth-shaking movements in the development of the new republic. So for this reason, First Baptist Church Philadelphia, despite its relatively small size, takes on a great deal of significance. It's an important church because of its location. It was throughout the 18th century a member of and an active participant in the Philadelphia Association, which is the oldest and perhaps the most important historically, the most important association in the United States. Now, during the 18th century, First Baptist Philadelphia faced several really severe trials before we come to our era. And I just want to mention these. For example, Philadelphia was occupied by British troops from September 1777 to June of 1778. And this occupation hindered the churches, especially because many of their members had to flee. The man who was at that time pastor of the church, William Rogers, actually enlisted in the Continental Army as a chaplain. And so for a period of years, the church was without a pastor. And so between 1775 and 1792, it lost more than half of its members. It was cut in half. And that's largely the period of the war with Britain. Now, not all of the decline, however, was war-related. A very famous incident took place in October 1780. The church extended a call to a young man whose name was Elhanan Winchester. He accepted the call and came, took up his place as pastor of the church. Again, the historian of First Baptist Philadelphia, William Keane, says this: "This was a most unfortunate decision. At first, he was most successful and drew large crowds. I can't tell you if he had any effect on the weather of Philadelphia. He drew large crowds, including many clergymen. That ministers from other churches came to hear him. But within a year of his coming to First Baptist Philadelphia, he had become a universalist. He believed in universal restoration and that all men ultimately would be saved. This led to many bad things. Again, let me quote from Keane. "Mr. Winchester was called upon by the protesters and requested to desist from preaching," that is, the members of the church who were concerned about his universalism. "The meeting house was locked against him and his adherents." So those who followed Winchester and liked him were locked out. So sharp, however, was the quarrel that on March 6th, 1781, the day after he was requested to give up preaching, his adherents broke open the church and took forcible possession of it. So his followers now break in, and they declare that they are the possessors of the church. Winchester preached on that evening, and on the ensuing Sunday administered the Lord's Supper. On Monday, April 21, 1781, the church invited six neighboring clergymen to advise them. After meeting with committees representing both parties, the council gave it as their opinion that the doctrine of universal restoration was a deviation from the Philadelphia Confession of Faith, and that those of the church who had pronounced against the doctrine constituted the rightful church. You see, you have two groups claiming to be the church. And these counselors say, no, the group that holds on to the Philadelphia Confession is the rightful church. Back to Keene. They recommended that Mr. Winchester be dismissed. As a result, the minutes for some time are full of exclusions of the adherents of Winchester. That is, the church records regularly begin to tell us that so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so, who were the followers of Elhanan Winchester, are being excluded from the membership. So there's a purge from the membership rolls of those who are committed to the doctrine of universal restoration. Keane goes on, "A lawsuit followed by which the Winchester party endeavored to obtain possession of the property, but on the ninth day of July 1784, the court decided adversely to their claim." See, this is a big problem that even ended up in the public law court. After Elhanan Winchester, the church called a man named Thomas Eustick, who was their pastor for just over 20 years. But one of the difficulties that he faced was yellow fever epidemics that broke out in 1793, 97, 98, and 99. Prominent people died as a result of this disease that came. Although the church made progress, and its membership was returned to pre-war level. So it was cut in half during the war, and then under the ministry, the 20-year ministry of Thomas Eustick, it grew back. Now, Eustick left in 1803, and now we begin to come to our time period. William Stoughton filled the pulpit for 1 year, and then he was called to the pastorate of the church. Now, even though they had somewhat recovered, they could not provide to him a full salary at first, but the church began to grow. Membership increased from 181 to 307 in 2 years. And by 1810 in his ministry, there were 473 members of First Baptist Church Philadelphia. So they were making progress. But in 1810, dissension once again entered into the church, and William Staunton and 92 members resigned in order to form the Sansom Street Church. Now, we'll come back to this later and talk about why this happened. In June 1811, after Staunton resigned and moved on with 92 members, the church called a man named Henry Holcomb, a South Carolina man who had been serving the First Baptist Church of Savannah, Georgia. And he accepted the call and came and served First Baptist Philadelphia until his death in May 1824. Now, during this period of William Staunton and Henry Holcomb's ministries, First Baptist Church of Philadelphia was involved in several very important events. There were six new churches that were planted in the environs of Philadelphia as it grows. Ministerial training was initiated under William Staunton, and as we heard earlier, the American Baptist Missions Movement, nicknamed the Triennial Convention, was inaugurated during this era. So some really good things happened. After Holcomb passed away, the church called William Brantley, another man from Georgia, and Brantley continued Holcomb's emphases, as we shall see. And our story will end during Brantley's time of pastorate of the First Baptist Church of Philadelphia. That's a brief history for this period of time. Now let me go run through these two brief biographies, and then we'll get to the main course. The first person we need to speak about is William Staunton. William Staunton was an Englishman who came from Coventry, Warwickshire, in the United Kingdom. He was born on January the 4th, 1770, into a home that already attended a Baptist church. In fact, his father was a deacon in that church, and when the family moved to London, they sat under the ministry of the very famous John Rippon. Staunton was converted while he was an apprentice in Birmingham, and he was baptized by Samuel Pierce. Samuel Pierce is another man that every one of us ought to know about. He, if you know the name Robert Murray McShane, Samuel Pierce is virtually the parallel of McShane among the Baptists. A great young man. His heart was full of missions, died very young. His story deserves to be told. Well, anyways, back to Staunton. Staunton trained at Bristol Baptist College, same place as Benjamin Bedome, and he became a popular preacher. While he was a student, he was present at the founding of the Baptist Missionary Society in Kettering in 1792. In fact, he was the youngest person attending. Actually, the records don't name him. There's a person who's written in there as anonymous. But others who were present tell us afterwards that it was William Staunton. Apparently, he was written in as anon because he wasn't a minister yet. He was just a student. But there he was at the formation of the Baptist Missionary Society. He came to America in response to an appeal by letter from Richard Furman, who, as we heard, was the pastor of the First Baptist Church of Charleston. And this letter was seeking a young man of promise and character to supply the church in Georgetown, South Carolina. Someone who was present says this: the letter was read at a meeting of ministers, and all with one voice exclaimed, "Staunton is the man." So he's a young preacher, held in high esteem. Richard Furman sends a letter to England looking for a young man to come, and they all agree that Staunton is the right man to cross the Atlantic. So he comes to Georgetown, South Carolina, and he serves there for 17 months. But there are two things that caused him difficulty there. One was the hot climate of South Carolina, very different from what he knew back in England, but also the practice of slavery. This troubled him. So he left the church in Georgetown, and he moved northward to New York. While he was there, he caught yellow fever, and everyone expected that Staunton would die as a result of his fever. But by the mercy of God, he recovered, and he was offered a position as a teacher in an academy in Bordentown, New Jersey. And this position, now remember, he had graduated from Bristol Baptist College, so he was recognized to be a man of some academic ability. This appointment at the academy brought him into the sphere of the churches of the Philadelphia Association. Now, to move the story forward more quickly, in 1805, after Eustick had passed away, Staunton was asked to be pulpit supply for 1 year at the First Baptist Church of Philadelphia. Someone says, it's actually in Staunton's memoir, that this was perhaps the smallest church in the city at that time. So it's relatively insignificant in the city of Philadelphia. And as I said before, the church didn't even have enough funds to support him full-time, so he continued his teaching work. The church, though, during the year of his interim pastorate, things moved forward. He was pleased with the church, and they were pleased with him. And so in March 1806, he was called to be their pastor. He was 36 years old at this time, and the church grew very rapidly, so that soon the building had to be enlarged in order to be able to hold the crowds that came in to hear William Staunton preach. Only a few years later, 1810, he resigned from the church. Now, one of my frustrations in reading all of these old records is that sometimes they don't tell you explicitly what the reasons are. You have to read between the lines. And so, as I read between the lines, it seems to me that there may be two or three reasons why Staunton moved on. The first one seems to be poor treatment from some of the members in the church. Well, they're Baptists, you know. And it probably was the case that not all of them treated him with the respect that he rightfully deserved. Secondly, it seems that Staunton, now this is the era leading up to the War of 1812. It seems that Staunton may have had sympathies with the crown rather than with his adopted country. And he's in Philadelphia. In fact, one of the criticisms that's made of the new church that is formed is someone says, one of the other Baptist pastors says, it will be an English church. That's not a compliment. That means it will be a church that reflects the ethos of Great Britain, not of our new nation. And so it may be that Staunton and the 92 who left with him were viewed as sympathizers to the British cause. But a third and more positive reason, that, and it's the reason that Staunton himself gives, is there was an opportunity to plant a new church. Philadelphia is expanding outward, and this new church is located in the western suburbs. Now, I think probably today it would still be an inner city Philadelphia. But in 1810, it's the outer suburbs on the west side, the Sansom Street Church. And Staunton goes out there with these people, and they form the new church. They are dismissed from First Baptist Philadelphia. It's not a split. They actually are dismissed. So there's a positive sense to this, but they are dismissed to form a new church on the west side of the city, and it's called Sansom Street Baptist Church. And they choose William Staunton to become their pastor. He'd been in First Baptist, now he moves to the west side, he's pastor of another church. And that church, the new church, begins to grow rapidly. They build a large building, the meetings are well attended, and it was like Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones' ministry that we just heard about. The Sunday evening services were better attended than the Sunday morning services. There were many guests, even many of the elite of the city of Philadelphia would come to hear Staunton preach in the evening. So he's not just a rising star, he's a star among the clergymen in Philadelphia. He's held in high esteem. But not only is that true of his stature in Philadelphia, it's also true of the view that his brothers in Baptist churches around the country had of him. He served in positions of leadership in the Philadelphia Association, in the American Baptist Board of Missions. In 1817, he was chosen to be the principal of the new Columbian College, the attempt at ministerial training. In 1823, he resigned from Sansom Street Church and he moved to Washington, D.C. in order to serve the college. He was chosen to be a chaplain to the U.S. Senate. And due to ill health, he finally resigned as principal in 1827 and died in 1829, William Staunton. Now, Henry Holcomb. Henry Holcomb was born on September the 22nd, 1762, which made him 8 years older than Staunton. He was born in Prince Edward County, Virginia. When he was young, his family moved to South Carolina, apparently to rural South Carolina, because he never had formal education beyond age 11. That was the end of any education that he had. But he was obviously a very intelligent man, very clearly self-taught, but had a great intellect. Besides that, one of his biographers tell us that he stood 6'2" and weighed 300 pounds. So he was a big boy. And there's one of the books has a portrait of Henry Holcomb, and the portrait makes him look like a big man who's quite imposing. I'm not sure that I'd want to go up to Mr. Holcomb and have a conversation with him. I think I'd be afraid of him. Well, he served in the Continental Army and rose to the rank of captain, and there was confronted with the gospel. And around age 22, he was converted, and after a study of Scripture, was baptized by immersion, according to the New Testament. His gifts were such that soon after, he was licensed to preach, and then he was ordained to the gospel ministry on September the 11th, 1785. Along with 25 others, he baptized his wife in 1786, about 2 months after marrying her. He's a rising star in the ministry of the churches in the South. He was chosen to be a member, he was so prominent that he was chosen to be a member of the South Carolina Convention, which ratified the Constitution of the new nation. You know how that worked? The Constitution is proposed, then sent out to the various states, and they have a convention that ratifies it. Holcomb was one of the men who was chosen. And in 1791, he became pastor of the Yeehaw, South Carolina Baptist Church. Now, this ensued in an invitation to Savannah, Georgia, in 1799, and there he helped to organize the First Baptist Church of that city. It's actually interesting, the history of First Baptist Savannah. There was a group of Baptists who were meeting together and actually built a building, but they never constituted as a church. They began meeting in the mid-1790s. It wasn't until Holcomb came, even though they had a building, it wasn't until Holcomb came that they actually formally constituted, and you have a Baptist church. So you have Baptists meeting together, and then you have a Baptist church. That's First Baptist Savannah. He was also very active in the community. He formed a society to help and educate young female orphans. He published the first national Baptist paper in the United States. It was called the Georgia Analytical Repository. He helped to found Mount Enon Academy, as well as a committee of ministers to support missions in Georgia. But a period of illness forced his resignation from the Savannah Church in 1810. And so he went into a period of recuperation when he had no formal relationship to a church. In late 1811, the First Baptist Church of Philadelphia heard about Holcomb, and they extended to him a call to come and succeed William Staunton as pastor of First Baptist Philadelphia. And this was his place of service for the rest of his life. Now, a man who had done well and who had been used by God in many ways. However, the historian, we need to say something about his personality. The historian of First Baptist Philadelphia, William Keene, says this: Dr. Holcomb, though a man of deep piety, seems also to have been a man of quick temper and rather arbitrary conduct. And that's an important observation about him, corroborated by his friends. For example, back to Richard Furman. Furman had problems with Holcomb in 1797. Furman, who was pastor of First Baptist Charleston, heard of the need of a Baptist minister to go to Savannah and organize a church. And so he suggested a young man who had been trained at Rhode Island College, whose name was Cook. He thought that Mr. Cook was a promising candidate for the work in Savannah. But Holcomb was insulted by this. He believed that Furman had no right to insert himself into the situation because Holcomb had his eye on the situation in Savannah. Now, there's a series of letters back and forth between them. Furman, a diplomat, a man of gracious spirit, replied to Holcomb that he did not know of Holcomb's interest in the city. Holcomb replies, "You must have known my interest in the city." But Furman, being the gracious man that he was, backed off. But you begin to see tensions in the relationship between Furman and Holcomb. One of Furman's close friends, Edmund Botsford, who was another prominent Baptist minister, wrote to Furman and told him that he thought that Holcomb was vain. Because in print, Holcomb went into print to praise his own work. That's not usually something that's a very good idea to do. People ask you to write blurbs for books. You don't write a blurb for your own book. This is the best treatment ever done of such and such a subject. Apparently, Holcomb did something like that. In the year 1800, he expressed the fact that he was insulted that the Charleston Association minutes didn't make mention of the fact that he was ill. Me, look at me. Other instances of this character flaw could be produced, but it takes on great importance as we think about the problems in First Baptist Philadelphia. Now, under his ministry in Philadelphia, we encounter three significant problems with the Triennial Convention, a problem with the Philadelphia Association, and a charge of confessional heterodoxy near the end of his life. This pamphlet that I bought addresses the third of these, but we need to understand something about all three. The first is the problem with the Triennial Convention. Our brother Dave Hendricks did a wonderful job of telling us about this earlier. The Triennial Convention is the popular name that was given to the first organized missions effort among Baptists in the United States. It was the result of the conversion to Baptist principles of the New England Congregationalist missionaries, Adoniram Judson and Luther Rice, while they were en route to India. Rice was single, and he returned home to raise support for Judson with the intention of going back to India. The Baptists quickly took up the cause. They organized for missions, and drawing from both southern and northern states, as we heard from Georgia to Maine, 34 men came together to form the Baptist Board of Foreign Missions for the United States. The very first meeting was perhaps an indication of the troubles to come. Because the first committee that was formed to write a constitution for this new convention, and it included both Staunton and Holcomb, failed. And it was necessary for the convention to appoint a second committee and make it a second attempt. The first group included 15 men, way too many, 15 out of the 34. The second group had only 5 men. The smaller group was successful, managed to propose a constitution, and it was adopted by the delegates. Richard Furman was chosen as president, Henry Holcomb was chosen to be first vice president, and William Staunton was chosen to be the corresponding secretary. And Luther Rice was the traveling representative of the convention. So we're talking about men who are right at the center of the work of missions from the beginning. One author, Vail, the man that Dave referred to earlier, indicates that a personal and ecclesiastical controversy between Staunton and Holcomb already was occurring, and it boiled over in 1815, and we'll see it again in a few moments. Holcomb does not seem to have approved of Luther Rice, and he believed that he should return to India and not serve as a representative of the board in America. But the board voted to keep Rice, to employ him, to charge him with the responsibility of traveling all of the East Coast states in order to raise funds and to raise awareness of the cause of missions. Holcomb protested. He was dissatisfied, and he resigned from his position on the board, along with a couple of others who seemed to have been his constant companions. There was a cadre of men here. Holcomb is at the lead, but he has his supporters. And so now we have a rift in the Triennial Convention. A book, or really a pamphlet, entitled Plain Truth was published. And this book was full of letters that were attacking William Staunton. Many contemporaries attributed these letters to Holcomb. And Holcomb went on the defense aggressively, seeking to clear his name while laying the blame squarely at the feet of Staunton. Now, you have two prominent ministers in the city of Philadelphia who had been working together in the Triennial Convention, and one is seeking to undermine the other. It was really a bad situation. And it was recognized by all as totally unhealthy and sinful. I'll read you a quote or two in a few moments. Richard Furman was a diplomat. He sought to relieve the tensions, but his actions, when you look at what Furman did, they seem to have favored Staunton. I don't mean by that he took the side of Staunton, but I think rather his actions point to the fact that he recognized that the real problem was Henry Holcomb. On a journey to Philadelphia, for example, he stayed one night with Holcomb. He paid his respects to him, but then the rest of his stay was at the house of William Staunton. By 1816, Holcomb disappears from the published writings of the American Baptist Mission Board. And then he publishes a book called The Whole Truth Relative to the Controversy Betwixt the American Baptists. And in it, he accuses the board of duplicity by expunging his name along with another person without explaining how or why this was done. But now we have a pattern. Lengthy books and pamphlets of self-vindication flowing from Holcomb, or sometimes flowing from First Baptist Church of Philadelphia. And from this point onward, Holcomb begins to write against the board and against its programs. He actually begins to say, well, associations of churches, a convention like this, doesn't have any scripture basis, and so we ought not to have them. What he used to believe, now he begins to attack. I don't think that we should say that Holcomb was against missions, but I think that Holcomb was against the effort of the convention, and there is a distinction there. But that's the first problem, the Triennial Convention. The second problem is at the same time, but it's with the Philadelphia Association. What happened there? In October 1816, there was a problem in the First African Baptist Church in Philadelphia. This church had been planted with the aid of First Baptist Church Charleston, and it faced some difficulties. The difficulties were over who should be allowed to come to participate at the Lord's table. And the result of the difficulties were that two groups emerged, each of them claiming the name and the rights of the First African Baptist Church of Philadelphia. So they went to the association, and they asked the association to help them sort out the problem. Each group was allowed to present its credentials and make its argument to the association. And after they were examined, one group was recognized and admitted as the First African Baptist Church of Philadelphia. The other was not recognized in the same way. Holcomb alone, of all of the members of the association, believed that the wrong group had been accepted into the association, and so he issued a bitter protest. Once again, one man against everyone else. And he does what his pattern has been. He publishes a protest. This seems to have been exacerbated by a particular and personal dispute with William Staunton. Staunton's church, the Sansom Street Church, remember, they left, 91 members went with him. Staunton's church had grown wonderfully, and Staunton was placed in various positions of prominence. Holcomb seems to have been jealous. In fact, this book that Dave talked about, Richard Furman, Life and Legacy, the author here, Rogers, suggests that since Staunton's ministry attracted some of the elite of Philadelphia, Henry Holcomb was jealous of the people who came to listen to William Staunton, his predecessor, and 8 years his younger. An incident between the two brought the matter to a head in October 1816 at the association meeting that was held at First Baptist Church of Philadelphia. Now, in the evening, there was to be a preaching meeting. And it had been agreed at the previous meeting that William Staunton would be the preacher for that evening. When Staunton stood up to preach, Holcomb rose, and the literature says he countermanded the announcement, quote, declaring that the person nominated, that is Staunton, should not enter his pulpit. The association considered this a gross insult. That's the language that they used. And they said that it had always been the prerogative of the association and its moderator, not the host pastor, to make preaching assignments. So they had assigned Staunton to preach. The time came for him to preach. It's in Holcomb's church, and Holcomb stands up and says, no, I will not allow this to happen. Creates a scene. Holcomb said that the matter related to another minister in Philadelphia, a man named William White. White also was a prominent man, a member both of the Philadelphia Association and of the Baptist Mission Board. Holcomb accused him of wicked behavior, but the association defended him. And the association records indicate that though Holcomb used White as a reason for the dispute, quote, Mr. White was never once named in the various unpleasant discussions. So Holcomb is interjecting something that was not present so far as the association was concerned. The result of this dispute was the removal of First Baptist Church Philadelphia from membership in the Philadelphia Association. And even that becomes a matter of contention. Because First Baptist Church records state that the church withdrew, while the association minutes indicate that the church was excluded. In any case, there was a major rift right at the heart of the city of brotherly love. In the 1819 association minutes, there is what they call a corresponding letter, which describes the position of the association on the matter. I meant to read it. My time is running away. I won't take long to do that. It simply says, there is nearly unanimous agreement in the association. There was one dissenting voice from all of their actions. They were united in what they did, but Holcomb stood against them. And from this point forward, First Baptist Philadelphia changes its tune and begins to attack the association, to go after it. Now, that's always the refuge of malcontents. They disavow what they had previously supported. And that's what Holcomb leads First Baptist Philadelphia to do. In fact, they published a long, dreary account of the matter, and there was no reconciliation with the association until 1895. In Philadelphia, First Baptist Church was largely isolated, though Holcomb had ministerial friends who supported him. The third thing, now my pamphlet, the charge of confessional heterodoxy against Henry Holcomb. This pamphlet is a really interesting posthumous defense of Holcomb that was published by the First Baptist Church of Philadelphia. Well, what happened? A deep division seems to have erupted between Holcomb and the deacons of First Baptist Philadelphia. They had a church order that was pastor-deacon. And about 70 people followed the deacons and resigned or were excluded. Now, once again, it depends on which side tells the story. 70 people resigned or were excluded. They charged Holcomb with heresy. And they applied for membership in the Philadelphia Association under the name First Baptist Church. We're the true church. They were actually accepted into the association in 1827. And the whole affair degenerated into a lawsuit between two claimants to the name and property of First Baptist Church. Now, what was this about? Well, Holcomb had published two editions of a book called Primitive Theology, which in the mind of the deacons and the others had crossed theological boundaries and had contradicted the teaching of the Philadelphia Confession, which is basically the Second London Confession. And though he died in 1824, the court case continued, and his supporters in First Baptist Church Philadelphia published this pamphlet to assert that they never denied any doctrine of the confession. Now, this was perhaps technically true, but it's also misleading, because in this pamphlet, they argue that Holcomb, number one, was orthodox in his published views, and that, number two, he had published these views as a private individual and not on behalf of the church. So they're sort of trying to distance themselves by saying, if there's anything unorthodox, that's his views, not our view. The association, of course, responded by saying, but they were preached in your church. There were lectures given at your church, and no one has protested apart from these 70 or so people who leave to form another church. Well, what was the issue? It's really complicated, it's technical, and my time is running away, but it has to do with the nature of faith. Holcomb argues for what he calls the attainability of faith. That is, that faith may be attained without the working of the Spirit, because God has given to all men certain things that allow them to believe. The Calvinists in the Philadelphia Association view this as a lengthy step towards Arminianism. Holcomb's views really reflect the times. He writes at the height of the Enlightenment, when empirical evidence and rational discussion are central virtues of intellectual society. Holcomb sought, both in Savannah and in Philadelphia, to enter into the intellectual world of his day, not realizing how profoundly it influenced not just his worldview, but his theological perception. And so from his perspective, faith based on irrefutable evidence is sufficient to bring a person to Christ. It's sort of evidence that demands a verdict, is what it is, sort of. The first lecture in primitive theology, which is titled On Christ's Mediatory Honors, is an important corollary to his doctrine of faith. When I first read it, I was confused by its empiricism and rationalism, because he seems to argue that a fair-minded person will receive the facts of Christ and his glory and fall on his knees before the Savior. Faith is a gift of God generally, not specifically, and it's attainable to all men. When you read this chapter together with his exposition of the nature of faith, one understands Holcomb's point. Based on a faulty surface reading of select texts, he attempted to allow the human mind the ability to access faith when gospel facts are presented, and all the while insisting that this doctrine is consistent with the confession of faith. Now, his views were considered by most of his Baptist contemporaries to be against the doctrine of the Philadelphia Confession and contrary to the prevailing predestinarian system that reigned among the churches. The dissident group, these 70 who left, were admitted to the Philadelphia Association because they were considered to be the faithful adherents to the confession. So by the standards of the association, Holcomb was in error. He was outside of the bounds of the confession, and the dissident group was the rightful heir to the name and rights of First Baptist Philadelphia. And it went to the courts. And the Supreme Court of the state of Philadelphia, ultimately ruled in favor of the smaller group. They agreed that the smaller group was the consistent group. The matter continued to be debated for a long time. It became, now there are two churches, and ultimately they were able to come to a mutual agreement, but it took a couple of decades for them to settle matters of property. When the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the smaller group, they gave them the rights to all of the property. The larger group protested, and they were able finally to work things out between themselves. That's in a sense a good resolution to a difficult story. Now, my time is up. There's more that I want to say. There's one more thing that happened. Holcomb, after his death, handpicked his successor, William Brantley. Powerful man who can speak from the grave. Yeah. Brantley picked up where Holcomb left off. But he was not content with having a church that was outside of an association. So what do you think they did? They formed a new association called the Central Union Association of Independent Baptist Churches. And what's really interesting about this association, if you're interested, come see me later, they explicitly state that they will not allow a confession of faith to rule over them. They form a new association and say, though our churches subscribe to the confession, we will not allow this confession to rule over us in our association of churches. It's fascinating. Here's the language. An association of delegates is not empowered either to form or publish confessions of faith to be rendered obligatory upon the churches which they may represent. So you have a new association alongside of the Philadelphia Association that is anti-theological, that forms on the basis of certain projects that they want to do, activism. It's revivalistic for sure, but it's about activism. It's a loose theological union that gives lip service to the confession but enervates its usefulness. This is the logical conclusion of Holcomb's thinking. He was a brilliant but untrained man who had an outwardly successful ministry with the appearance of great usefulness. But like others before and after him, his idiosyncratic theology, bound together with a domineering personality that was easily offended, caused a terrible rift in the early Baptist movement. Some of his contemporaries deeply lamented the state of contention that was present in Philadelphia. Well, I have some thoughts at the end. I'll skip over most of them, but let's say this. Let us remember those who came before us. They are our brothers and sisters, and we will share the glory of heaven with them, with Holcomb and with Staunton. Even with all of their faults and their failings, we have them as well. We see these in their sins and in their graces, but let us, by God's grace, flee from their sins and emulate their faith. Even though divisions may come, good can be the result. Several churches were actually planted in the Philadelphia area, and the cause of missions, despite the problems of infighting in the board, moved forward. We ought to rejoice that the Lord of heaven and earth accomplishes his purposes despite our sinful selfishness. You know, maybe if you think about this, with missions as the cause, maybe we shouldn't be surprised that the devil strongly opposed something so important even at the beginning, because he knew that the cause of missions for which the Baptists were uniting would advance Christ's kingdom. It's sad. Furman, in commenting on Henry Holcomb, says that the devil got in and the devil used him. It hindered the cause, but it didn't prevent the triumph of the gospel in moving forward in the cause. Please forgive me for going over time.